Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. We have the Book Nook coming up for you. And today we'll be talking about a book called Acid Hype, American News Media and the Psychedelic Experience with Stephen Siff. He's a professor at Miami University in Oxford. And Stephen was fascinated by the media coverage that he found for the drug LSD back in the 1950s and 60s. And he wrote this study about it. We'll be talking to him about acid hype. But first, NPR News. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Stephen Siff. His new book is Acid Hype, American News Media and the Psychedelic Experience. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Vic. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Steve, this is kind of fun because you are a professor at Miami University in Oxford. You're in the Department of Journalism. And we are calling you on one of the campuses of Miami University, but it's in a place that I didn't know they had a campus until we arranged this interview. Tell us where you are.
Well, I'm at Miami's campus in Luxembourg. It's actually one of the largest American university campuses in Europe, and we've been here since 1969. It's in a beautiful chateau in the town of Differdange, about just a couple miles outside of Luxembourg City.
You know, I don't think I've ever interviewed someone in a chateau before. How are the amenities?
Oh, just wonderful. Lovely. It's ivy-covered. The foundation of the chateau, of the little castle, was from the 15th century, but the rest was built in the 30s, so it has plumbing and electricity, all the amenities.
Wonderful. Steve, this book, Acid Hype, I'm wondering, how did you get the idea to investigate this? What was the genesis of this project?
Well, this project began for me about 10 years ago when I was looking through Time magazine archives online and came across these remarkable articles about LSD that were published in Time in 1963 and 1966. That made these explicit comparisons between taking acid, taking the hallucinogenic drug, and the experiences of Catholic saints like Saint John the Baptist and others. And so, just seeing this this really remarkable comparison between these respected religious figures, obviously, and the experiences of people taking acid. Really, really made me think, because that is not something that you see today. And that sort of openness towards describing drug experience, just apart from the enthusiasm for it in the magazine, was really surprising to me then. And I wanted to look into how that came to be.
What you're saying is that you were surprised that they hadn't gone negative on LSD yet in the mass media.
Not that it was... Not only that they hadn't gone negative, but that it was described in such unabashedly positive terms. And not only that, but in such unabashedly positive terms in Time magazine, which was strongly identified with the Republican Party, and its publisher, Henry Luce, was kind of a figure on the right for years. The magazine was known for its kind of conservative-leaning coverage of American politics and other issues, social issues, too.
Well, it certainly didn't hurt that apparently Henry and his wife, Claire Booth Luce, were sampling LSD.
Yeah, and that was really one of the surprising things to me. At the same time that Claire Booth Luce was serving roles on Richard Nixon's presidential election committee, she was experimenting with acid in her home. And the contrast between those things was for me really surprising and interesting, that this substance, which would be so thoroughly identified within a couple of years with the hippies and the Vietnam War protesters and almost a certain kind of anti-Americanism, would have been embraced by these deeply establishment figures.
Stephen Siff joins us. His book is Acid Hype: American News Media and the Psychedelic Experience. Let's go back. I'm sure a lot of our listeners don't know anything about the history of LSD, and you fill us in this book. You talk about how it was discovered and the process that was involved. What a fascinating story. Can you capsulize that for us, put it in a capsule or a sugar cube?
Yes. The drug was synthesized for the first time in 1938 by Albert Hofmann, who was a pharmacologist in Switzerland for the company Sandoz. And this is a molecule that does not exist in nature. This is a synthetic molecule. And when he first synthesized it, the first experiments were just on animals, and the people at Sandoz had no idea that the drug really did anything. So it sat on the shelf for about 5 years. And then in 1943, Hofmann accidentally absorbed some of it through his skin and had this, an acid trip. And this was a very powerful experience for him and extraordinarily well documented. He kept laboratory notes from that experience and from that day. And, you know, the day is celebrated now as Bicycle Day by people who are interested in acid, because he went for a bicycle ride from his home after experiencing this drug. The drug was recommended for researchers for two purposes. One was that they can give to patients who were in traditional talk therapy. And the thought was that taking LSD would release the unconscious memories and give talk therapists access to their patients' thoughts and dreams and subconscious ideas. And then the other use was for psychologists to take the drug themselves, so that they could experience what was thought to be the experience of being insane. There are a lot of superficial similarities between an acid trip and the experience of a schizophrenic. In both cases, the person experiences hallucinations, hears voices that aren't real, will talk to himself sometimes. There is a crucial difference, of course. People who are having a genuine psychotic episode don't realize that what they are seeing is a hallucination, what they're seeing is not real, while for the most part, people who are on LSD do realize that their fantasies are not reality. But this distinction wasn't really appreciated at the time. And so the drug was shipped out to researchers both in the United States and around the world for experiments with patients, and then many physicians started taking it themselves for this scholarly purpose and discovered that they enjoyed it. By the mid-50s, there are lots of stories of physicians and psychiatrists who are receiving the drug and enjoying it at the laboratory, having parties in their home where other sort of forward-thinking intellectual types would also take the drug to have this experience too.
The book is Acid Hype: American News Media and the Psychedelic Experience. Stephen Siff Rohde joins us today on the program. Aldous Huxley played quite a role in gaining entree for LSD, didn't he?
Yes, absolutely. And Aldous Huxley wrote this book, The Doors of Perception, in 1954, which describes a mescaline trip. Mescaline is a sort of similar drug to LSD, and by the time the book came out, a lot of people read it with LSD in mind. And this book describes really a fantastic experience by Huxley, a very literary experience where he describes experiencing the world as an artist experiences it and having what was really a deep spiritual experience. And this book was widely read at the time and remained in, I believe it's still in print, remained in print for years, and was read by many, many people who never took LSD, and I think was read by many, many people before they took LSD. And I think this very literary interpretation of the drug experience, which was, as one critic at the time said, 99% Huxley and 1% acid, really came to define the expectations of a lot of people who came after him. And, you know, the media description of this experience, I think for many people, became the experience that they would strive for.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Stephen Siff. His book is Acid Hype, American News Media and the Psychedelic Experience. It's recently been published by the University of Illinois Press. We'll continue our conversation with Steve right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and Stephen Siff joins us. His book is Acid Hype, American News Media and the Psychedelic Experience. This is quite a work of history, and I remembered a lot of these personalities and these stories, these rumors that you relate in this book. You know, the one about if you take LSD and you stare at the sun, you'll go blind, and just, you know, the birth defects, just all the dangers of LSD. Now, it really didn't turn, though, until what, about 1966? Is that when they started kind of going negative about LSD?
That's right, during the last couple of years of the 60s is when those rumors started coming out about the people going blind from staring at the sun. I remember when I was in college in the 90s hearing those same kinds of rumors. I remember hearing that if someone took LSD a certain amount of number of times, they would be considered legally insane.
Mm-hmm.
Or stories too about a young man who thought he was an orange and tried to peel himself. These really memorable anecdotes, and it's interesting to see how many of them had a specific starting point. The story about the kids, the college kids taking LSD and staring at the sun until they went blind, was originally reported in the Times in the 60s and debunked within a few years. It turned out the story had been made up by a official in Pennsylvania who wanted to scare kids away from doing a drug they thought was dangerous. And yet the rumor has persisted for years and was reported in the media for years, even though it was known to be factually inaccurate.
Once you get a good rumor going, there are so many personalities in this, and I'd love it if you could talk about some of them. I have a list of some of my favorites. One of them, who I was familiar with because I can remember going to see the movie Reefer Madness back in the day, a guy named Harry Anslinger. I think he's a key figure in all this.
Oh, I think so, too. Harry Anslinger is, he's kind of one of the baddies in drug history, I think. He was in charge of federal drug enforcement from 1930 through the 1960s, and he was involved, so this is the period that saw marijuana becoming illegal, and he was lobbying on behalf of that, and through the 1950s, when again the U.S. government cracked down and put stricter drug laws in place, his philosophy, at least during the beginning of his tenure, during the first couple of decades, was pretty different from the way we think about anti-drug warriors today. He kept a file, he called it his gore file, of horrifying stories about people who smoked marijuana and then murdered their family with an axe. That was one of them. Stories about rape and murder that were allegedly caused by weed, and he would spread those to journalists, and as well as sometimes repeat them himself in magazine articles and in congressional testimony. So that's not so different from what we see today. You know, and we see sort of extraordinary negative stories being repeated by people who have a stake in drug prohibition. But what was interesting about Harry Anslinger, too, was that his insistence, again, through the first 20 years of his tenure, that the drug problem, although drugs were scary and evil, that the drug problem was small and under control, and that his department had it under control, that he was doing such a good job that additional laws generally weren't necessary, and that as long as you scared your kids away from it, the problem wasn't so bad. He was pushed out of office in the 60s, by which time he had seemed like something of a dinosaur. During his last years as a public official, he talked a lot about how China, communist China, was behind the drugs being imported to the United States and playing on Cold War fears.
Mm. Amazing. I think one of the more interesting people that I discovered in your book, Steve, was a guy I had never heard of, but he was a former Wall Street banker with J.P. Morgan, a guy named R. Gordon Wasson. Tell us about him. And he was married to a woman who was also very much involved, a woman named Valentina Wasson.
That's right. They were amateur scientists. Wasson was a successful Wall Street banker. He was in the field of PR, considered one of the forerunners of PR for banking companies. And he taught in New York also. And Valentina, his wife, was a pediatrician, which was remarkable at the time, that she was a woman pediatrician trained in London. And during their marriage, they began this hobby of mushroom hunting and then of writing about mushrooms, kind of exploring mushrooms. And this is almost, you can picture him almost as a Victorian figure, as an amateur scientist collecting knowledge from mostly by writing letters to figures around the world and traveling on their vacations and searching for mushroom artifacts and signs of mushrooms in ancient texts. And during this, they started developing a pet theory that all human societies could be divided into two categories, those that loved mushrooms and those that hated mushrooms. And from this, they sort of reached back even further and determined that mushrooms, that hallucinogenic mushrooms, were the cause for these strong feelings. And they started finding evidence of hallucinogenic mushrooms in ancient, in Indian texts, in ancient Christianity. Now, a lot of this was not the kind of thing that would be accepted by scholarly sociologists, and it wasn't at the time. But because Wasson was self-funded and he published his own books, he was able to kind of continue this chain of inquiry and get his word out about this. Now, he became famous for his mushroom hunting in 1957. When Life magazine published a major story describing their discovery of magic mushrooms, hallucinogenic mushrooms in Mexico. And this was really a story of adventure. He wrote in the magazine about how he and his wife tromped around Mexico looking for this magic mushroom as the key to his theory about the origins of religion. And ultimately, he found it and took mushrooms in a hut in Mexico, and had fabulous visions. And he believed that the woman who gave him the mushrooms had ESP like powers as a result of the drug. And this story, when it came out, made a big splash, and it was heavily promoted both by Wasson and by Life magazine. The same week that he published his story, his wife wrote a long story that ran in This Week, which is a Sunday newspaper supplement, and that reached millions of readers. I think it was in about a dozen Sunday newspapers at the time. And very quickly, he followed up on that, granting interviews, and he released a Smithsonian recording of chants that were associated with mushroom rituals. And he used all of his PR skills that he developed in industry to kind of promote his discovery of magic mushrooms. I mean, it's interesting that we would think about magic mushrooms, which had been used by Native Americans for centuries, as being discovered. But the existence of these substances had been lost to Western science. In the 1930s, there had been some confusion between magic mushrooms and mescaline, which is the cactus button that also has hallucinogenic effects. And the people who categorized fungi, the botanists, had been unable to locate the mushrooms. And so white scientists, for the longest time, didn't believe it existed. And up to Wasson's discovery, these sacred mushrooms were kept from outsiders. They were kind of kept as a religious secret, in part, no doubt, because their use had been discouraged by the Catholic Church in Latin America. But after Wasson published this story, within a year or two, the drug tourism industry to rural Mexico had blossomed, and Bohemians were coming across the border to try magic mushrooms in Mexico, and the landscape had completely changed around this drug. Suddenly, they were being sold in the street where when Wasson had showed up, they were impossible to find.
Stephen Siff joins us. His book is Acid Hype, American News Media and the Psychedelic Experience. You've got a number of illustrations in the book, and one of my favorites is the cover of This Week magazine from that date, May 19th, 1957, with a picture of Valentina Wasson, and they've done a really lovely job on the cover. There's this giant stone statue of a giant mushroom with a face, and it says, "I ate the sacred mushrooms." I love that. That's just, it's so, so classic. And they put out a book called Mushrooms, Russia, and History, and I understand that this book is very rare. Were you able to get your hands on one?
Well, I looked at the original in Wasson's archive at Harvard University. His archive is kept in the in a botany library there, and then you can also find it online if you search. The PDFs are available online. It really is a remarkable book. It's the work of an amateur scientist, and it seems like almost something from the Victorian period where people would strike out in pith helmets looking to discover corners of the world. The hallucinogenic mushrooms appear almost as a footnote to this book. They only discovered them when the book was nearing completion. And so it's just in the very last chapters, they find this confirming evidence, which suggests to them anyway, which proves to them that their theory was on track.
I think if you went out and asked just an average person who lived through this era the name of the one person that you would identify with LSD, that the number one choice would be a guy named Timothy Leary. Let's talk about him.
Yes, Timothy Leary, Mr. LSD. He's an interesting character for sure, and he had an interesting life after the period of this book as well. But Leary tried hallucinogenic mushrooms while on vacation in Mexico, and this is right after he had gotten his Harvard appointment. He was a troublemaker from way back, having gotten kicked out of school, having trouble in the military, having trouble when he was a student at getting kicked out of West Point, and very much a rebel by nature and a heavy drinker. But when he discovered LSD and magic mushrooms, he really became focused immediately on the power of these drugs. Like many who've taken, like many who've taken LSD, he was entranced by his own experience and convinced of its universality. He believed that LSD could be used in every field of study to improve people's thinking, and was utterly convinced by this. That's perhaps not so surprising to most people. I think what would be surprising, or disheartening, maybe, is the extent to which he fudged on some of his research conducted in the early 60s, some of the seminal studies that at the time were taken as evidence for the potential of LSD to create behavioral change and to help people grow. One of the most famous experiments that Leary ran, a rather long-running experiment at Concord Prison in Massachusetts, was represented as showing that the inmates who took part in psychedelic drug experiments while prisoners had lower recidivism rates, were less likely to return to prison. And it turns out, in retrospect, scholars who've examined the work have found that the numbers there were fudged. Another famous experiment that was conducted under Leary's watch was called the Marsh Chapel experience, or sometimes the miracle at Marsh Chapel, when Leary and a graduate student working under him gave LSD or psilocybin, I believe, to a number of theology students who then had religious experiences. And what he didn't mention in the reports on this or in his publications was that one of the people who took the drug had actually had a really terrible reaction and ran out into the streets madly through traffic and had to be restrained and given a sedative to calm down. So a lot of Leary's representations about the drug experience and even about the drug experiences he was involved in downplay the serious negative reactions that also occurred.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today on the program, my guest is Stephen Siff. His book, Acid Hype, American News Media and the Psychedelic Experience, has just come out, published by the University of Illinois Press. He joins us by telephone from the campus of Miami University in the European nation of Luxembourg. We'll continue with our conversation with Steve right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO with Stephen Siff on the program today. His book, Acid Hype, American News Media and the Psychedelic Experience. You have so many wonderful anecdotes in this book. And when I think about LSD, I think about the year 1968 and the presidential election that year where Richard Nixon defeated Hubert Humphrey in a very close election. And Nixon was very much running on an anti-drug ticket, wasn't he?
Yes. Anti-drug, anti-Vietnam War demonstrators, anti-disorder. And I think for him, the drug use of the youth really represented the worst kind of willful disobedience of the law. He saw himself as representing a return to order, and to see people flouting the law was offensive to that. Nixon had very little patience either for the Vietnam War demonstrators, the marijuana smokers, or the acid heads at the time. And when he came into office, he was involved in reformulating the U.S. drug the federal drug legislation in a way that that made LSD among the most prohibited drugs in the country.
Nixon and his cohorts keep trickling through this account, and one of my favorite little subplots and anecdotes was the one where you point out that during one of these famous drug busts, the guy doing the bust was an assistant prosecutor named G. Gordon Liddy, who went on to fame, if you could call it, as one of the Watergate burglars.
Yeah, isn't that funny? G. Gordon Liddy ran a bust on Timothy Leary at his upstate New York house in Millbrook, New York. They didn't find much when they busted him. At that time, Leary claimed that he was not doing LSD anymore and had turned all of his attention to taking morning glory seeds, which were and remain legal, of course. But I think they found some trivial amounts of drugs in the home when they busted it. It was in many people's views at the time a politically motivated bust because Leary was so outspoken in favor of drug use, and his home in Millbrook had become something of a commune, something of a haven for people interested in drugs, for hippies and other freaks.
If I had to pick a favorite anecdote, it also relates to the Republican Party of that time, and it goes back to 1972. The Republicans were holding their convention. They were going to nominate Dick Nixon to run for re-election. And during the convention, you have an anecdote where Clare Booth Luce is in a hotel, and I believe that convention was in Miami, and she encounters the yippie, Abby Hoffman, who then asks her if she's ever dropped acid.
And she says, according to Hoffman's report, yes, but she wouldn't want everyone, she wants to keep it out of everyone's hands because she doesn't want people to have too much of a good thing. Now, that's how Abby Hoffman tells the story. Funnily enough, there was another witness to this conversation, however, a writer for the New York Times, who repeated nothing of the sort.
Joe McGinnis.
Who said that that Hoffman was sheepish and polite and made up the story for his book, which is quite possible. So.
Did Hoffman close the conversation by saying to her, "See you in Nirvana"?
Yes, that's right.
I love that.
He claims anyway. Although it would be completely like Abby Hoffman to make up a wonderful story like this, it would not be unlike, he was a great prankster, of course, and a great manipulator of the media. So,
you have a lot of stuff in here about the movie star Cary Grant. He was an acid user.
Yes, and very outspoken about how effective he thought the drug was in helping him come to terms with his personal problems and how he felt it made him a better man, a better husband. Yeah, he took the drug in the late 50s, and by 1959 he was talking about it in pretty good depth with interviewers for fan magazines and just general women's magazines. Cary Grant being, of course, one of the great movie stars of that period. And he spoke favorably about LSD until his death. He really believed that it did wonderful things for his personality and for his and in particular for his relationship with women. Now, it should be said that Cary Grant went through a divorce after making these statements. And one of the remarkable characteristics of LSD is that the people who take it are often entranced with the profundity of the experience that they have. And people may be entranced with the profundity of the experience, whether or not it genuinely changed their life or changed their behavior. So,
I think it's important to note that LSD was not illegal until the mid-60s. And when they made it illegal, there was quite a debate about that. A lot of people, even in government, did not want to make it illegal. Explain.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, because there was the perception, probably accurate, that many of its users were college students and young suburban kids, and there was a reluctance to make these kids into criminals. And that was the perspective that was stated by the head of the FDA during Senate hearings during the late 60s, and of many U.S. senators. There was the feeling that the people who use these drugs are our children, and there are probably better ways to help them than to, again, make them criminals, to put them at risk of going to jail.
Stephen Siff joins us. His book is Acid Hype, American News Media and the Psychedelic Experience. In your chapter, Moral Panic and Media Hype, on page 151, you have a sentence where you state, quote, "To this day, no physiological side effects from LSD have been found." That's quite a statement.
Well, yeah, that's correct. Now, there are many anecdotes, many examples of people who've had really serious psychological problems, and sometimes only from one use. Whether that causes psychological problems or brings to the fore psychological issues, latent depression or latent schizophrenia is subject to debate. And there's no question that use of the drug has damaged many people. But there's no physical harm from LSD that's been discovered anyway. Scientists did manage to kill an elephant with LSD by injecting a huge dose into the poor creature. But LSD is not going to hurt you physically. It may hurt you mentally, and you know that's the problem.
You went back and you looked at all this archival material, all these publications and media coverage of all sorts, movies, music, you name it, magazines, lots of newspapers. We hardly ever hear about LSD anymore in the news. Does it still exist? Are people still using it? Why is there no coverage?
Well, I think it does still exist, although it's been largely supplanted by other drugs. I think MDMA, ecstasy, has probably taken a bit of its niche. And you do hear of LSD occasionally, but it's being used in a very different context often. You'll hear about LSD being used at raves or being used as a party drug, which is very different from how the people thought about it in the 60s and early 70s. One of the really remarkable things about LSD is how incredibly potent it is. A very, very small amount of the drug, a tiny fraction of a gram, is enough to set somebody off on an eight-hour trip. And so when an underground laboratory sets up, it's possible to create millions of doses in a single underground lab. So with LSD, and I should also say its synthesis is not particularly easy. So with LSD, you will see a lab opening up and there being a lot of LSD for a period. And then when that lab is ultimately shut down by police, you know, the drug will disappear. This was the case in the 90s for a while. There was a lot of LSD distributed through the Grateful Dead tours, actually, through people who traveled with the Grateful Dead.
No.
I know. That's shocking. Shocking, isn't it?
Yeah. Wow.
But, you know, with one laboratory able to really produce the nation, you know, all the LSD that could be used by the nation, I mean, literally millions of doses. I think it sort of changes the dynamic of how the drug spreads.
Stephen Siff joins us. His book is Acid Hype, American News Media and the Psychedelic Experience. What was the process like? You say it took about 10 years. What did you start with and how did you go about it? It sounds like you had to go to a lot of libraries.
Yes. Well, I began by searching on the internet, of course, and finding what I could that was written about the drug from this period and looking through scientific journals to see how the drug was being studied and to kind of evaluate some of that work. And then I also visited the archives of some of the notable people involved here, of Gordon Wasson and Claire Booth Luce, and then looking through letters and papers of other people who were significant in its history.
In your acknowledgments at the beginning of the book, you thank some of your colleagues, and you say, I have received invaluable advice from professors Richard Campbell, James Tobin, and Joseph Sampson. Just by one of those weird coincidences, my producer here in the studio is Richard Campbell's brother-in-law. Small world,
oh, well,
huh?
Small world. How nice.
What was the process like for you as a faculty member at MU? How did that work? How did you interact with your colleagues on this? What kind of assistance did they give you?
Well, Both Professors Tobin and Campbell were wonderful in giving advice and in reading early drafts and suggesting how to approach and deal with publishers. I think writing a book is a solitary endeavor by its nature, but it was wonderful to be within a community of scholars and other people who are involved in this kind of work to give support and guidance.
How do you deal with publishers?
Well, from as politely as possible, I guess. This book is published by University of Illinois, and Illinois is my second publisher. I was with Missouri for a while, but then the university shut down the University of Missouri Press briefly and sort of sent letters to all of its writers that your book may or may not, you may, that telling us that we may want to seek another publisher because their future was uncertain and they may not be in the academic publishing business in the same way that they were in the past. And so then I found myself searching for someone else to take on the book, and I was luckily enough to find Illinois pretty quickly. But getting an academic book published, I think, is becoming harder and harder. They don't make money for the publishers, and so it's tough.
The book was orphaned then by the Missouri Press, and you were able to pitch it to Illinois.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. I think the first time I saw you, you were in the Underdog Cafe in Yellow Springs, and I spotted you, and you were wearing some kind of a Cleveland sports shirt. And I said, the Cleveland whatever team it was. And you kind of looked at me like, who is this guy, and why is he talking to me? And then we ended up having some conversations later on, and I found out about this book, and we stayed in touch about it. And I'm wondering, are you actually from Cleveland? Tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your background? How'd you get into this line of work?
Well, I grew up in Massachusetts, but my parents moved to Cleveland when I was in high school. And so I was been in and out of Cleveland for about 20 years now. Although before I got into academia, I was a reporter at the Vindicator in Youngstown, Ohio.
Oh, wow.
And I've been around Ohio for a while, although more the northern part of the state. But then I was involved in the strike against the Vindicator a couple of years ago. And then after that, went and got my PhD at Ohio University in Athens, and then was lucky enough to land a job at Miami.
So you began as an ink-stained wretch in the Vindicator.
Yeah, that's right.
What was the strike about?
Well, the strike was, for me, it was about solidarity with the union. But the newspaper guild at the Vindicator went out on strike based on a whole number of issues, but the biggest one actually had to do with delivery drivers and wanting delivery drivers to use their personal vehicles when they made deliveries rather than the fleet of cars that the Vindicator maintained at that time. And the organization of the union was such that reporters and copy editors were in the same union as the drivers. And so when the drivers voted to go out, we went out with them. And we were out for about 9 months before we ultimately approved a contract and went back to work.
Stephen Siff joins us. He's a professor of journalism at Miami University in the Department of Media, Journalism, and Film, a highly regarded department. With the landscape in journalism these days, with the decline of daily newspapers and all the new media, all the internet stuff going on, what's your take on the current situation? What do you tell your students when you're giving them advice about what they should look at and where they might want to consider trying to go with their careers?
Well, you're right. It's everything is in flux now, and all of the old school media has been, there many of the old school media has been laying off. There are many journalists thrown out of work. And that's the downside. But the upside is that people are reading more news than ever before, and our access to news and information is better than ever before. And there are just tons of people doing interesting work. And the opportunity to do interesting work and to do it on your own in some cases, or with a news organization, is greater than it ever was before. In the past, I think people were much more constrained to doing a single job or a single specialty, working in a single media. And now it's possible to tell stories in all different ways and to really express yourself in your work in a way that I don't think it was so long ago. So I think it is a really hard time. I think it's a hard time, especially for people who grew up in the news business. But for people starting out, I think it's a very exciting time, and there are lots of opportunities at the kind of organizations that you know, you and I probably wouldn't have imagined would ever exist a couple of years ago. I mean, specialty outfits that report on sports, places like Vice Media that does all sorts of interesting reporting aimed at a sort of youth market, just all sorts of interesting stuff. And, you know, so I think if you're willing to take risks and just throw yourself out there, it's possible for a young person to be a part of that. I should say our graduates do very well. You know, the industry as a whole is in a tough spot for sure, but young people who have the right skills, who are tech savvy, who are comfortable working with data, who are comfortable working with images and video, find great jobs. So, I mean, that's the hopeful part of it.
Stephen Siff is my guest. His book is Acid Hype: American News Media and the Psychedelic Experience. This is very much a work of and about journalism and the connection between journalism and the acid hype. I love the way you tied these two things together.
Well, you know, as I said a bunch of times, I do think LSD was a really remarkable drug, and one of the reasons it was so remarkable is that there is no really observable reaction to it. It's all sort of in the person's head. And I think the way that journalists reported about it and promoted it, and especially when they were promoting it with such hyperbolic claims about how, you know, how LSD would bring enlightenment and change every field of study and make people think differently and make you have these experiences of saints. I think reading that kind of created that experience for some people who took it. I don't know what percentage of the people who took it actually managed to achieve the wonderful things that were written about it. But I think it really shaped the ambitions, the drug-taking ambitions of that generation. And, you know, it's interesting to look after that period. The ambitions have shifted. You know, the drug is still around, maybe not as much as back then. But even in the 60s, there wasn't as much acid as people might think. I mean, marijuana was the drug that was ubiquitous at the time. Acid was still a pretty niche item through the 60s. But yeah, I think all the writing about it and all the thinking about it really made it seem central to that generation. You know, we think of acid as being a drug of the 1960s, but in fact, it was much more commonly used in the 1970s, in the early 70s, than it was in the 60s. Mm. The difference was that Timothy Leary was no longer out there shouting about it, and it wasn't being covered so extensively in newspapers and magazines and even in the movies. So it's sort of the public impression was that it had gone away.
Well, this really is a fascinating study, and I found myself chuckling through quite a bit of it because so much of it is so bizarre and so absurd, and you read an account, I think it was only like one sentence about a magazine like Sports Illustrated saying, well, gosh, they should put LSD in a lake and see what the fish do, you know, something like that, and you just think, that is just so crazy, and yet back then, people were thinking about that stuff, and it seemed like a normal observation. It's just amazing.
Yeah, well, I think we forget, too, that there was this period of excitement about drugs in the 1950s. Now, remember, this was the time when effective antipsychotic medicine was just being discovered, where minor tranquilizers like Valium were coming out for the first time. And there was this realization for the first time that the mind was a sort of chemical organ and that it was possible to tinker with it and maybe make it better. And Americans, you know, Americans aren't really opposed to drug use, right? We take all sorts of drugs all the time. You know, Prozac, all sorts of antidepressant drugs, all kinds of drugs.
Brew kettle, White Raja.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they're just some drugs that we don't like, and it's usually the illegal ones that we look way down on. And before LSD was made illegal, it was possible to talk about it in a different way than afterwards, for sure. And there was a lot of hope that we could really improve our mental capacity, use the whatever percentage of the brain that we're not using now. By playing around with these substances, and that hope was not just limited to a couple of college students, but that was a hope that was expressed in mainstream magazines, mainstream thinkers.
Steve, we really appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Our guest has been Stephen Siff. His book is Acid Hype: American News Media and the Psychedelic Experience. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening.